traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
On my least favorite topic.
It's okay. All right, so apparently our last introduction worked, so Jeremy's trusting us with the second time. But we are here on the Sports Medicine Broadcast. I am Randy Harris with my wife, Sandra.
Hi.
We are both the co-host of the AT Corner Podcast, so thank you again to Jeremy for letting us kind of co-host these episodes. We really appreciate it. And we are here at the Sports Medicine Update in 2023. Like we were saying, we have Dr. Salapas here. We're going to do a follow-up on facial injuries, the evaluation and management. It was a great presentation, and I know it's one that Sandra holds dear to her heart.
Very dear.
Do you want to get us started?
Yeah, so Dr. Salapas, I know we were talking a little bit before about this, and you know, I've talked about this a lot on our podcast, so if you're a longtime listener, you would know how much I dislike facial injuries. How common are these facial injuries actually occurring?
I mean, it's around 20 to 40% of all sports medicine injuries actually involve the face. But sometimes it's just something a little bit like, hey, you know, I got slapped in the face while they were trying to reach for a ball during a soccer game. It could be something as simple as that, or like, you know, bumping heads during basketball. You know, most of the times when we think of like head injuries, there's usually like a concussion mechanism, you know, involved mm-hmm. and things like that, like headers, basketball games, ball to head kind of things like in volleyball. So those are things that you're like, oh, you just got hit in a concussion. But like the ones that are more serious are like soft tissue injuries, right? And you can see that with like high velocity forces, like in soccer, basketball. I've covered professional rugby for the last 5 years, and facial injuries kind of happen on a weekly basis with that sport. But it's something that you just have to be aware of, and then knowing, trying to be comfortable with managing mm-hmm. it. There's a lot of organ systems involved in the head, and people don't realize that.
Yeah, when I think of facial injuries, the first thing I think of is blood. Just be prepared for blood.
Blood, yeah, blood. You know, if they're spitting out blood, and I was like, all right, what hit? What
mm-hmm.
you
got? Yeah.
Are you having a nosebleed and you're just sucking it back and then spitting it through your mouth? Did you chip a tooth? Why is your cheek all numb? You know, like, did you break a cheekbone? Yeah, so it's one of those things, you know, like in an on-field assessment, you just like ask them, like, what happened? What hurts? And then that's when you can kind of hone in on their differential, you know? You know, we have our auditory, our visual, mm-hmm. our smell, our taste symptoms. It's like all the senses actually are involved in facial injuries.
So when you do have a facial injury, where does your mind go as far as initial assessment? What are you looking for?
Well, hopefully if I'm on the sideline and watching it, I'm watching that mechanism. But the first thing I go to is I go immediately to the player and I make sure that they are talking and having an airway, right? Because sometimes those things can be dicey real fast. Mm-hmm. So if they're like, ow, I think this guy just clipped me in the ear or something, like, okay, good. You're breathing, you're talking to me, okay, and then I can hone in. So the very first thing I always think of is airway and communication. Once I've established that within the first like 2 seconds, then I give a little bit of an exhaled relief and then we'll see what's going on from there. Great question.
Yeah.
I know you talked a little bit about ecchymosis and when those could be potentially dangerous. Can you talk a little bit about ecchymosis and when to refer with that?
Oh, yeah. So like in my talk, I was basically saying like the two kind of ecchymoses or bruising that I really worry about is what we call the raccoon eyes. And it has to be both eyes, where they have that kind of like raccoon eye look, where that bruising is on the bottom side of their eyes, because that's where you're concerned, like, did they have like a basal or skull fracture? Mm-hmm. And that is something that's like, hey, the brain is right there as well. And that's one of the things that you just have to like, hey, we need to send you to the ER. We need to get a CAT scan to make sure that your like skull is okay. So that's one of them. The other type of ecchymosis is that when they see the ecchymosis on the behind the ear, we call that a battle sign. And typically they're also tender in the mastoid process, like right in the base of the skull. And if they're tender there with some bruising, that's another sign for a basilar skull fracture. And that's the one where you go ahead and get EMS involved and get them to the hospital.
For those kind of skull fractures, is surgery common for that? Or is it just kind of like, hey, we're just trying to make sure the actual brain tissue's okay with the CT imaging and stuff?
Yeah, it's usually with CT imaging. If it looks like it's a little crack or if it's just like really bruised and it's just bruised, but it's, you have to assume, you know, mm-hmm. like with a lot of things, you just assume skull fracture until otherwise noted.
Mm-hmm.
So not all require surgery, but mm-hmm. it's something that you have to rule out.
Perfect.
I know something that stuck with me from one of our earlier talks was the dentist who came in and gave their talk. They were talking about how mouthpieces can actually help prevent mandibular fractures because of like the condylar, because of the way that the mouth guard separates the upper and bottom teeth. It actually takes the condyle of the mandible and kind of like brings it inferior and anterior. So I thought that was really interesting. And mm-hmm. then you kind of touched upon mandibular fractures in your talk as well with, just like you were saying, with the airway and the management. With these, are we looking at surgery for those, or is it non-surgical?
It depends on what kind of fracture it is. If it's one of those fractures that, hey, it doesn't look displaced,
mm-hmm.
then you can do conservative management, and they'll be okay in a couple of weeks. They'll probably have to be on a soft diet, you know, like pureed stuff, because, you know, mm-hmm. opening their jaw hurts. If you fractured your jaw, chewing hurts, right? Mm-hmm. So they need to have a soft diet involved for a couple of weeks as that heals. Now, the important thing about those athletes is that, especially if they're a high-level athlete, if like in the elite high school, collegiate, or professional, nutrition has to be important too, right? You don't want them to lose weight, lose mm-hmm. the calories, lose the protein that they lose because they can't chew their food, right? So you have to think of like high protein puree foods. And I know we have our sports dietitians here in this country. I'm sure they have a better way of like discussing that. But nutrition has to be one of the top things with like jaw fractures to deal with, to make sure that when it's healed, we're not losing too much time off of the or with recovery back to their sport.
During that healing time for a mandibular fracture, what is the athlete allowed to do?
Like, what I was just about to ask.
Yeah,
that.
What are they like safely allowed to, like, what kind of activities?
It's going to be as tolerated. Okay. You know, if they can lift, if they can exercise, probably light exercise, because you know what? Sometimes when you're like really doing like full circuit training and sprints, people tend to clench their jaws. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. you probably do. You know, when you're trying to sprint, you're going to tighten up your jaws and stuff like that. So it's probably going to be like light cardiac exercise, some weight training to where that they're able to do something, but it's not like so stressful that they're trying to clench their mm-hmm. jaw. And especially if they had a fracture, if they're going to try to do too much, they're going to feel it as well.
Interesting. Yeah, you never really kind of think of that until obviously you have a mandibular fracture.
Right, exactly.
In your talk, you also talked about just that difference between the return to play as far as like, hey, non-contact, hey, maybe 4 weeks, but if you're looking at a contact sport, it may be 2 to 3 months. For that contact athlete, what are you kind of looking for to make that determination of that return to play maybe at 2 months instead of 3 months? Is there any criteria you're kind of looking for?
It really depends on the sport and their position. Got it. You know, I've taken care of players with like facial fractures mm-hmm. that even though the literature does say 2 to 3 months, I've gotten them back in a month.
You okay.
know? It's like, well, you know, if, for example, sorry, I'm like relating this back to like rugby, cause it's like the sport where facial injuries are like regular in the scrum. Like if you're like a forward in that scrum, right. And it's all like head to neck, mm-hmm. you know, it's not just face, it's like head, neck, shoulder kind of stuff, pushing against, you know, if they're that, then I'm like, hey, you may need to take a couple more weeks, maybe towards a 2-3 month part. But if you're like the guy in the back, mm-hmm. you know, like you're a winger and your job is to just run fast and throw the ball. It's like, well, just try not to get hit in the face.
That's always good advice. I like that.
Yeah. And, you know, and in soccer, you know, if they're feeling pain-free and they're not having too much pain, they can open their jaw up and down, or if it's like a cheekbone fracture or something like that, and then if it's like a couple of weeks and it's healing, that's where you consider, hey, maybe you should just play with a mask.
Got it.
So I don't work rugby, and you were doing a great job at making me feel really good about my decision not to work rugby.
It's a great sport.
But I know that you were talking about the some of the regulations in rugby that they aren't allowed to wear certain masks or
Protective gear.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say protective gear is not allowed in rugby. It's but basically hard shell things.
Okay.
So in rugby they use a lot of padding and electrical tape.
Mm-hmm.
Rolls mm-hmm. and rolls of that to either pad their AC joints, pad their thighs, protect the ribs, whatever it may be. So you have to get a little creative on how to do certain padding. Like I showed in the picture of a rugby athlete with like a nasal fracture, they literally just used electrical tape and padding and went over the nasal bridge, making sure they had vision in their eyes. It kind of made this like weird, you know, weird looking mask with just like three pieces of equipment.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty creative. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. So the only thing that they can have in rugby, aside from the like the padding and the taping, is a mouth guard. So
got it.
TMJ dislocation is another one that you talked about that I have not seen, luckily. But can you also talk about the relocation process that you discussed?
Oh yeah. So most of the time when the TMJ is dislocated, it's usually kind of down and outwards, right? So the way reduce that back is putting a little bit of some posterior pressure and then try to push that back in. Because usually the TMJ is kind of like that U shape, so then it kind of moves forward out. So you're just trying to move that back in. So if you're going to attempt a TMJ dislocation reduction, wear gloves and then roll some pads on your thumbs. Because like the way the picture shows it, and like I said, I've only had to do this once, is that you have to get their thumbs on the bottom molars and see if you can push it down and then go inwards a little bit to see if you can reduce that joint back. So I usually, the one time I did this, I actually wrapped a couple of like Curlex, like 2x4s, and just really pray that he doesn't snap my thumbs. And this is, it did go back in. He didn't like bite in, but I just had his thumbs closed, like, okay. And then I really just moved my thumbs a little bit out and got into his cheeks and took out, and he was okay. But I did that once. I did not put that person back in the game. I was like, let's just call it a day.
Yeah.
And see how you feel. Even though the guidelines said that if they're feeling okay, they can kind of, depending on the sport, you could theoretically put them back in. Like, but I just didn't feel comfortable.
And that's the bottom line.
Yeah.
Right.
Is there any like particular follow up for that? I mean, obviously you want to possible x-ray to rule out any other fractures, but are there any like MRI or anything, because you do have the meniscus also and the like at that TMJ joint?
Yeah, usually if that's the case, once they're feeling okay, depending on, I'll probably follow up with them or ask the electrician what their symptoms are, if mm-hmm. they're having anything in the 24 hours, because that's where I kind of determine, do I need to send you to like head and neck
okay.
to see that? Or if you're having some teeth issues with that, maybe do I need to send you to a dentist, or you can get the oral maxillofacial person who has an MD and a dentist degree and see if they have, see if they can chime in on any recommendations for further follow-up.
Got it.
But typically, if it's back in, it's like most, you know, dislocations, everyone gets one in their life, right?
Yeah.
Per mm-hmm. joint.
Yeah.
So if it's only a one-time thing and they're okay after a couple of days, like, okay, let's just watch it.
Got it. Perfect.
So for a maxillary fracture, this is the one that I hope that I never see. Have you seen one of these clinically?
No. Well, not in sport.
Okay.
So most commonly, maxillary fractures are usually from like motor vehicle accidents, motorcycle accidents. So outside of a case of like a high impact trauma dealing with the automobile, I've actually never seen one in sport. It takes a lot of effort to fracture a jaw. And probably the one sport I can see that may have the highest risk would be any type of combat sports.
Got it. I thought it was interesting because I didn't know about that splinting technique for like a mandibular fracture and stuff. Is there a particular technique to splint like a Lafort fracture or anything like that?
You can do that Barton's bandage technique as well. Because what you're doing is that you're just trying to really just, you know, keep that skull and jaw in place.
Got it.
I feel like that reminds me after you get your wisdom teeth out and you just sort of trying to like keep your ice on your jaw.
Yeah, and then they wrap that bandage over it with the ice. Yeah, it's kind of similar. But the only way, like, the only difference is that you have to kind of wrap that around the forehead too so they can get a better control. Yeah, better lock.
You showed some great pictures of zygomatic fractures. What are the key signs of a zygoma fracture?
So it could go two ways. One way, they have that really big swelling right onto the cheekbone, or there's no zygoma bone. Or the opposite way, is there a dent in said cheekbone? You know, I showed that picture of like Russell Westbrook from the when he was with the Thunder. He had that kind of dent, and there was that LAFC player that I showed that had it a few years ago too. Both were, I think, were managed surgically. Well, I know the LA Galaxy player, I'm not sure, probably Westbrook. If there's a dent, they probably need to fix that. But then they were returned back to their sport in a few weeks wearing a mask.
That's amazing. That's crazy.
And I think when LeBron, his wasn't a zygoma fracture, I believe it was a nose fracture.
Yeah.
He wore that, his Zorro mask, so to speak. And I think the most famous player that actually wore a mask for was probably Rip Hamilton.
Yes.
So like with the Pistons, I know I'm dating myself here with 2000s NBA basketball, but I think he wore that for a couple seasons. I think it just became who he was. In this
I mean, when you build a persona, you know, might as well keep it going.
Yeah, exactly.
So with the nasal fractures, when can you get them back to sport?
With nasal fractures, like I said, it depends on the sport and position. Typically, it is a couple of weeks, sometimes 4 to 6. But like I said, I have had nasal fractures where I've sent them back in like 2-3 weeks, as long as they're pain-free and they feel like they can breathe okay.
Yeah.
That's usually the thing. And if a couple of weeks, and if they can breathe, you know, okay, and it doesn't hurt when they actually push on the nasal bridge, I'll let them go back and play.
Awesome.
With a mask?
Depending. Plus or minus, it depends. Okay. It depends on the player, too. Because the thing is, it's like nasal fractures, sometimes it's not the bone. It could be the cartilage. Mm-hmm. So, like, if the x-ray doesn't show, like, hey, your bone didn't fracture, but it was more of the cartilage and they feel fine after 2-3 weeks, I'll let them play again.
I've only seen one displaced cartilage of a nose, and it was jujitsu, and it didn't bleed. It literally was just displaced, and the kid could breathe okay, and we just referred him to get it reduced. But
right, yeah, and that's sometimes the case too. And then in the case of like mask wearing regarding that, sometimes the player just wants that for comfort, just to make sure it doesn't get injured again. And like I said, in certain sports, like in combat sports or rugby, sometimes when the nose is broken, they'll just continue to play. And they're like, there's that other question, is like, when should I get this fixed? You know, because sometimes people have that like crooked nose, and it's, you know, and I tell them like, when you give up the sport is when you get it fixed. Like, if you're going to play next season, you're going to break, there's a chance you're going to break it again. So wait until you hang up your cleats and then get it fixed.
True. Speaking of the nose, you had a good chat on nosebleeds.
Yeah.
And we've all had that one athlete that, man, this nose just is not stopping. At what point is this kind of like an EMS call, like on a nosebleed?
I would say with the nosebleeds is when they're actually having symptoms of kind of like lightheadedness, okay, or dizziness, when I think there's a little bit too much. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, those things that just can just continuously bleed sometimes, yeah, like, mm-hmm, over the course of like an hour. You're like, man, it's like I'm trying to stop this. It's still going. But I would say if it's like, if they're feeling lightheaded or having a headache, it's like, hey, I don't feel good. Or if they're feeling nauseous or something like that with the nosebleed, you know, could there be other things involved with the nosebleed too? Are they having some like symptoms of like concussion just like kind of emerging right in front of you while you're trying to manage this nosebleed? So,
got it. So that actually brings up a good point, because, you know, with nosebleeds, typically you want to have them leaning forward. But if they if they're dizzy or lightheaded, you would typically lay them back. So how would you manage that while you're...
Yeah, that's a tough one too. You know, it's maybe just like tilting the head, and then just really just kind of pinching and seeing if you can do the best. Like, you know, maybe tell them to just maybe just sit down and not necessarily lay down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would be an option too. Because like the always concern is that if you have them lay down and they're feeling dizzy and they're still bleeding, what if that, you know, obviously that the blood can go down to the back of the throat. What, mm-hmm, if there's something more serious going on, mm-hmm, and they're kind of like waning in consciousness, and then and they're out, and then you have to worry about like blood in the airway.
Mm-hmm.
You have to concern about too. So it's a tough one to answer. I don't know if I answered that right, but it's just one of those things you just kind of have to see what's best with the, mm-hmm, with the athlete.
I want to move on to orbital injuries.
Yes, let's do it.
I know I've suffered a few corneal abrasions in my athletic training career. Out at softball, the dirt got under my contact, and
yeah,
I've had a couple
or turf chips.
Oh,
that's so gross.
We're just working on our house, just like all the things that, mm-hmm, I've had a couple, but actually, I don't think I've had a corneal abrasion in one of my athletes. I've had foreign bodies.
Yeah, I see. Yeah. Like grass blade. Mm-hmm. You know? Oh, yeah. Like, or a, you know, they go for a touchdown and then, like, the chips of the turf just,
yeah,
get into their eye. And you're just like, yeah, I think I got a chip in my eye or something.
Yeah. Which is gross, knowing just what's on the turf, ugh, beads. Like,
oh, yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe that would be a case for the antibiotics you were talking, yeah, about, right, if you're worried, yeah, about, you know, infection.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
You also talked about eyelid lacerations, and you said to refer specifically to an ophthalmologist. Do they have ophthalmologists usually on call at ERs?
If they go to a big hospital system, this is, mm-hmm, the one where like you don't go to urgent care. You actually go to an actual ER that's attached to the hospital. They should have an ophthalmologist on call,
okay,
to deal with that. It's just because, you know, if you think about it, the skin of your eyelid is very thin, and there are tiny muscles involved that make it go up and down. So, mm-hmm, this is where, like, even ER doc will not touch this. Like,
yeah.
This is, you need, like, someone who actually deals with eye injuries. And also, in the lower eyelid, you know, you have your tear ducts there. So if you don't have the expertise of an eye doctor, you may, like, ruin some, like, tear duct glands, mm-hmm, as well.
Interesting.
So that's something to consider. But, like, with eyelid lacerations should be done by like an ophthalmologist or an oculoplastics person. Eyebrow lacerations, you know, ER doc, I do those left and right in rugby. But eyelid is something that needs a further expertise.
So for the eyelid lacerations, our job is mostly just control the bleeding and then refer?
Yeah, control the bleeding. Cover it when you can, just to prevent from any, you know, outside environment stuff going in. If it's an open eyelid stuff, that's the one we'll probably recommend, like if like a shield or some sort of cover,
mm-hmm,
and then and go ahead and refer, and then have them go straight to the ER.
Perfect.
I feel like the biggest question that usually, if someone hasn't dealt with a lot of facial injuries, it is, you know, we talk about the management strategies and when to refer, but I think the transition between those two, like what do I do with a like I have an orbital fracture. What, like, do I just send them? Do I have to stabilize them in some way? Do I have to pack in some way, or, you know, things like that? I think that's some of the transition questions are, what to do, in that, we say refer.
Like actually do, like the actual right. action.
The actual action part, I think, is the yeah. biggest.
Well, with any type of trauma, you know, I'll always go back to the ABCs, you know, check their airway, check their breathing, check the circulation. And if that's okay, if you're concerned of like an orbital fracture, then like that, the next thing I do is like evaluate the neck, you know, make sure there's no neck yeah. injury. So once you're okay with that, they can sit up, you know, they can, and then you can evaluate, it's like, hey, I'm having double vision. I feel like I can't move my eye up and down. You know, is it something like, did they have orbital floor fracture and then like the eyelid muscle or the eyeball muscle is like stuck on that where that fracture is? That's where you're like, okay, what hurts? Cover, take care of any symptoms, nosebleed. If the photosensitivity, put a cover in their eye and then just go ahead and refer and just continue to communicate with the athlete.
Awesome.
Are most orbital injuries something that you would refer to the ER, or are there some that you can kind of get away with more urgent care?
Like corneal abrasions, I think you can send to urgent care. You know, sometimes people sometimes get poked in the eye from a soccer game, mm-hmm. and like it's the contact lens that they were wearing just like scratch their eye. I mean, those I think you can send to like an urgent care, because then they can just do like that topical anesthetic and then make sure that all that will heal. So usually that, or maybe a foreign body, you know, if it's like a grass blade or something like that, I think those can be appropriate for an urgent care. Something that's more concerning if it goes to an ER is obviously like a globe rupture, eyelid laceration, anything that's concerned with like loss of vision, something mm-hmm. like that.
I think the last thing you touched upon in your presentation was on ear injuries. And I'm sure you've seen your fair share of ear injuries. But something that really stuck out to me was the ear magnets that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if you guys have ever heard of
I've
those.
Never seen that before. Yeah. I thought that was cool.
Yeah, yeah. And honestly, I didn't even know those existed until I started covering rugby. I didn't know even those yeah. a thing. But there are magnets out there that you can put like right in that outside ear just to squeeze it. And it's there for like, for prevention of cauliflower ears, you know. That's so, so if you are a jiu-jitsu or MMA fighter, and you're grappling and stuff like that, you have ear injury, and then you had the swelling, and then they put these magnets in, so because you know sometimes these swellings happen like the next day,
yeah,
right? Mm-hmm. With those auricular hematomas. So they'll just put those magnets in, like you know, just to keep it on after practice or after a fight, just to prevent. Swelling.
So if someone does come to you with cauliflower ear, how long do they have to drain it?
Well, hematomas, right? Cauliflower ear is when they didn't take care of the hematomas, and then they've created the cauliflower ear, and it's already mm-hmm. like gelatinized as a cauliflower ear. But prior to that, you know, they would have these like hematomas. So as soon as it's there and it's kind of mushy, I say, come in, let's drain it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've taken like 10 cc's out of an ear. You know,
wow.
And then the ear, once you take that that fluid out, or that kind of like that blood that accumulated in there, they go back and retain their shape. And that's where if the player has magnets, then they can do that. Or I wrap their head, you know, just get gauze and just wrap their head and keep the tips of the ears just flat and tell them to wear that for the next like 1 to 2 days.
So oh, okay.
Make sure it doesn't reaccumulate.
Awesome.
Does it have to be like the same day that you notice that the hematoma is developed, or can it be within the week or like?
It could be within the week or within the next couple of days.
Okay.
As long as it's squishy, that means I can get some fluid out. If you wait too long though, because you know, things get resorbed and things harden, and that's where mm-hmm. At that point, I can't drain anything. It's part of you now.
Yeah, it's there to stay.
Right.
Are there any really memorable facial injuries that you have had the opportunity to take care of?
No, just kind of funny scenarios. You know, like I said, it's always, like a turf pellet in the eye, blade stuck in the eye, some guy getting scratched with his like contact lens, and he's like trying to look for the contact. It's like, dude, just give up, man. You're not gonna put that back in. You know, just play without your contact lens. Nothing memorable. You know, I've had a lot of conversations about like return to play with like nose fractures mm-hmm. and things like that, and you know, and then getting them to return to sport. But and obviously, we're talking about all these like crazy facial kind of injuries, but the most common head injury I see, and I'm sure all of you, is it's a concussion. So, mm-hmm. but that's a whole different type of topic.
You got anything else, Randy?
Nope, that was perfect. Well, thank you so much for sharing your expertise on facial, eye, nose injuries. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah. And one last tidbit I was asked, like, remember, like, you have all five senses on your head. So those are the kind of questions that mm-hmm. I ask, like, are you able to see? Can you smell? Can you hear anything? Can you taste anything? Can you move it? So think of your five senses as well. And that's where I kind of ask those questions and start honing in on differential after that.
That's a good tidbit.
Yes, I like that. That's something you can definitely use right there.
Yeah.
And thank you again to Jeremy Jackson for allowing us to share his microphone on the Sports Medicine broadcast. We really do appreciate it. You can definitely get in contact with Jeremy Jackson through his Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. He is out there, a lot of episodes. He's the GOAT. And I'm Randy with my wife, Sandy, from the AT Corner podcast. She knows all our fine print a lot better than I do. I know we have our Facebook group.
You can find us on Instagram, AT Corner podcast. That's probably where we're most active.
Yeah. Perfect. And I'll channel my inner Jeremy Jackson, and that's a wrap.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.